Possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose 14th annual professor's lecture presents The Debate Between Einstein and Bohr and Its Consequences for Quantum Computing by Carl Hess on Wednesday, November 3rd at 7:30 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium, Spurlock Museum. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Last night, the Republican and Democratic candidates campaigning to represent the state of Illinois in the U.S. Senate, Alan Keyes and Barack Obama, met in their final debate prior to the election. This afternoon, we hear from another of the Illinois candidates running for the U.S. Senate, Jerome Kahn. He's the Libertarian candidate in the race. He was not invited to participate in the debates featuring the Democratic and Republican candidates. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Libertarian U.S. Senate candidate Jerome Kahn. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455-800-222-WILL. Let me give you some background on our guest. He is a teacher at the Harold L. Richards High School in Oak Lawn. He teaches economics and U.S. government and serves as advisor for the Model United Nations and government clubs at the school. Kahn, who is secretary of the Libertarian Party in Illinois, ran for the Illinois House in 2002. He received slightly more than 4% of the vote. Jerome Kahn earned his bachelor's degree in education from Northwestern University. He earned a master's degree from Governor State University in political and justice studies. He's married and lives in Oak Forest. If you have a question or a comment for us this afternoon, you can join the discussion. Join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Kahn, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yep. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. A couple of questions here at the outset. Maybe you would give us kind of an overview of the libertarian view. What do libertarians stand for?
Well, we believe in the concept of self-ownership. What that means is that we think every individual has the right to control their life and their property. Their property being what they acquired through their efforts, their work. So, I guess in some ways you can call the Libertarian Party almost the propertarian party, and that we believe in the sanctity of private property and the right of an individual to control that, and that includes the right to control themselves. The notion of individual liberty for us is of prime importance, and that's what we stand for in a nutshell.
How did you come to the libertarian view?
Well, I've always had libertarian leanings in the fact that I believed in the values that this country was founded on, and that I believe that's really what America was meant to be all about. That's what our revolution was fought for in 1776, is freedom from oppressive government, which sought to interfere with our rights to life, liberty, and property. The Declaration of Independence, of course, says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is kind of a modification of John Locke, who wrote Life, Liberty, and Property. So I think Jefferson, who had read Locke, had used that. But, I've always believed that. I'd been a Republican, really, until 2002, and I guess it kind of dawned on me during the Bush administration and with the George Ryan administration that the Republican Party, despite claiming that that's what it stands for, doesn't actually do it once they're in power. And so I decided to join the Libertarian Party and actually offer myself up as a candidate.
Hmm. Jesse Ventura, who ran on the reform ticket and was elected governor of Minnesota, visited the campus of the University of Illinois not long ago, and he called himself a small L libertarian. He said big L libertarians are anarchists. And I wonder what you think of his statement.
Well, you know, it depends on how, you know, people view anarchy as chaos and disorder and violence, and you know, I don't stand for any of that. If you mean by anarchy freedom from government oppression, if you mean by anarchy the what was sometimes called the natural order of the marketplace, where individuals can interact freely with one another and trade and form voluntary community organizations and run their own lives, well, then, of course, that would fit. You know, but anarchy as a word just simply means the absence of a ruler. And a free people has no need of being ruled by anyone. A free people can make their own decisions in mutual respect for each other's rights.
Hmm. So I guess the follow-up question to that is, then do we need a government?
Well, you know, I guess I'm getting into the semantics here, but yeah. I believe that government, to the extent that it should exist, should be a voluntary organization. I believe taxation is immoral. I believe it's theft. You know, some people would kind of smirk at the notion that taxes be made voluntary, but when you think about it, that would be the most effective check on government power, is the right of any individual who's dissatisfied with the services, who's dissatisfied with the way government is being run, may simply withdraw their support as an individual from that government. To the extent that government served the interests of the people that it served, you know, that it ruled over, if you will, then it would attract voluntary support. But I think most of the things that we use government for now can be done better, more efficiently in the marketplace. Government services could easily be provided in a free market setting rather than a coercive government setting. Hmm. So, yeah, I think to the extent that government coerces us to pay, forces us to serve, it is an immoral thing. And I don't think we're going to achieve the libertarian goal overnight. It may take generations, but for now I would settle, if I were elected to the U.S. Senate, is to kind of roll back many of these government intrusions on our lives. And that I think would be my goal as a senator, is to work hard to roll back government as far as practical within that deliberative body.
Yeah. It looks unlikely that you'll be elected to the yeah. U.S. Senate. So what do you hope your campaign will accomplish?
Well, you know, my campaign is partly to spread some new ideas, to try to pull the political center of gravity back in the direction of freedom and free markets. I think that both the Republican and Democratic Party have drifted into a more socialist type of mentality, and that's spreading throughout our political culture now. If you listen to my two machine party opponents in the debate last night, which I was, as you pointed out, I was not allowed to be in, they both basically are government men. They believe that government is the answer. Now, I know Alan Keyes periodically will employ libertarian rhetoric, but you'll notice when Phil Ponce asked him about the draft, he said he favors that. That's a profoundly unlibertarian idea, that the government should be able to force you to serve. We believe that if government's to exist, it exists to serve the people. The people do not exist to serve it. And I think that you find in both Barack Obama and Alan Keyes a mentality that the government should control you and be able to take your money. Alan Keyes favors getting rid of the income tax but replacing it with another tax. So that's the big difference I think I bring. And my campaign is an attempt to kind of show people that there is another way, that there is a way out of the problems that government has caused. And I was disappointed that I was not allowed to express those views on the debate. I think it would have made for a much more interesting debate, but, you know, those are things I can't control.
Hmm. If you were elected to the Senate, what would your priorities be?
Ending this war in Iraq. I think our occupation is illegal, immoral, and unwise. I think that if we did make a mistake in going there, as Barack Obama claims we did, then it's a mistake to stay there, which I find his position almost incomprehensible. Alan Keyes, of course, believes that we're right to go in and right to stay. At least that's consistent. It's wrong, but it's consistent. But, you know, my main priority would be to demand that the president remove our troops immediately from Iraqi territory, and as well as the territory of other nations. They don't belong there. And that would, I think, go a long way towards diffusing the cause of terrorism. I think that The government focuses a lot on the effects of terrorism, setting up these elaborate and coercive programs that rob us of our freedom in order to fight the terrorists. But what we really need to do is remove the cause of terrorism. That's a matter of changing the foreign policy that bred that terrorism. That would require politicians to take responsibility for their past mistakes, and that's why we're not hearing any of that discussion. But my second priority, of course, would be eliminate the income tax and all other taxes and move us towards a more voluntary type of government. But that's the essence of what I'd be standing for.
Well, let's go back to Iraq.
Okay.
If there was an immediate pullout, would you be concerned about chaos that would ensue?
There's chaos there now. Our troops are in the middle of it. That the Iraqis will need to work out some type of arrangement by which they can govern themselves, and I believe they would. It might be something different from what we have in mind. It might involve partition, even the country splitting up into smaller political entities because forcing people with different interests, different cultures, and even mutual hatreds into a single political entity, even under a democratically elected government, is a recipe for chaos. That the notion that if we have elections in January and a Shiite majority government is elected, that the Sunnis and the Kurds will simply acquiesce to that, I think is you're engaging kind of romantic fallacy. Democracy is not simply having an election. It's an attitude of tolerance and an attitude of respect for one another's rights. And until we achieve that, elections are meaningless.
What do you think of the Bush doctrine of prevention of preemptive unilateral action in self-defense?
I don't think it's self-defense. It's offense. When you invade another country that has not attacked you or threatened to attack you, you've engaged in offense, aggression. It was illegal under almost any standard of international law, if there could be said to be anything like international law. So I don't agree with that. I think that if we keep that by that doctrine, of course, we should be invading Iran. We should invade North Korea. We should invade Syria. We'd be waging war around the globe in numerous places, and I think that we picked off an easy target, I suppose, in choosing Iraq, a country that's been devastated by 10 years of sanctions and whose economy had been ruined by its corrupt leaders' incompetence. But I think it's a recipe for perpetual war, which, interestingly enough, serves the interest of the government in the sense that people will then turn to government for leadership, and that will enhance the status and power of our leaders. So, no, I vehemently disagree with the Bush doctrine. I think the United States military should be brought home and concern itself with defending U.S. territory, not invading or trying to manipulate the affairs of other nations.
Does the U.S. have a role to play in world affairs at all?
We have a role to play in the sense that we should be an open society with free trade and commerce, cultural exchanges with those people who wish to. We should open ourselves to them coming here and us going there. So by the U.S., when you say the U.S. people should be engaged in a world in commerce, in peaceful trade. I don't think we have a role in terms of meddling in internal politics of other countries. That's what's causing our problem. So, one person accused me of being isolationist, but it's really our current policy that is isolationist. When you send military forces into other countries, you alienate those people and turn them against us. When you wall off your borders and stop them from selling things here or stop your own citizens from buying things from others, that's basically walling yourself off from the rest of the world.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is the Libertarian candidate running to represent the state of Illinois in the U.S. Senate, Jerome Kahn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455, the number to use, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with some listeners. First, we're going to talk with a caller in Urbana. Line 1, hi.
Yeah, hi. It just seems very naive to me to think that you can have a government where paying taxes and supporting the government is voluntary. I can't imagine anybody actually doing that.
Well, perhaps it is hard to imagine, but that's merely because it hasn't been tried. That you know, that do you believe, for example, that it's moral, like if you were to teach your children, would you believe it was moral for your children to bully other children to give up their milk money or their lunch money because, you know, a group of kids thought that the money could be spent better? I mean, we teach our children that it's wrong to steal and that if you want something, you should ask for it or buy it or bargain for it. So I'm merely holding our government to the same standards that we would hold our children to, is that there are certain moral things that are moral and things that are immoral. And I think a decent government that commanded popular support would be supported, and to the extent that it wouldn't be supported, maybe it shouldn't be. But I don't think that's naive. I think it's an innovative idea that's never been tried. And given the mess that we've gotten ourselves into now, I think maybe it's time for some new ideas.
Okay, I'd like to make two more comments, and I'll hang up and listen to you. First of all, as far as the idea not having been tried before, I think there's a classic concept that has been tried. It's called the tragedy of the commons, which is that people never do. I mean, as soon as you have a pool in common, if people aren't required to contribute to it, they don't. And then my other comment is that you talked about how if starting the war in Iraq was a mistake, then staying in Iraq is also a mistake. And I would certainly agree that if we could, and of course we would have a president who was inclined to, say, hand over authority and control of Iraq to, say, the United Nations, for instance, then it would make sense for us to get out of Iraq. But I would say someone has to be in Iraq, and just from the standpoint of some armed force moving into Iraq, you know, just because it was a mistake to jump onto a train, to get onto a train or a boat, you know, doesn't mean that it would not be a mistake to it would be a good idea, you know, to jump off of the train or the boat once they're moving around in the middle of the ocean. So anyway, that's those are my two comments, and I'll listen to you on the radio.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you. Let me address the first comment, the tragedy of the commons. I teach economics, and I've, you know, of course, that's one of the things. The tragedy of commons only occurs where there is common property, like government-owned property. If you look at our national forests, for example, the most abused, most fire-prone forests are national forests. The most despoiled resources are those that are government-owned. Private ownership, I think, is the answer to that. That private owners have a right to own their property, and they take care of it because it is theirs. There's another kind of related concept in economics sometimes called the free rider problem. And then, of course, that's often used as a justification for coercive taxation. And that's the notion that if, for example, I walk down the street and I am enjoying the street lights because I have light that I can walk by. If I'm not forced to pay for them, I could still walk out on the street and enjoy the lights. Well, first off, that wouldn't happen under a private property system. But even if, you know, like I said, the notion that the street lights are paid for by voluntary means doesn't mean that people won't still purchase them. I would much rather deal with the free rider problem where one person enjoys the lights without having paid for it than force other people to pay for lights they don't want to use. In many cases, the free riders are the people that force other people to pay for the services that they enjoy. So I mean, so I think a society of private property, a society of volunteerism, would still enjoy things like streets and streetlights. It just simply would have to be paid for by user fees when practical, and by voluntary contributions when possible. So.
And the idea of jumping off that train.
Oh yeah, jumping off the train. Again, the thing about that is the United Nations has no more right to go into Iraq and rule the Iraqis than we do. The fact is, the longer we stay there, the worse this insurgency is going to get. The Iraqi people are proud people. They're an educated people, and they feel they're capable of running their own affairs. And I think if you put the shoe on the other foot and imagine it were Iraqi troops marching down our street, Iraqi troops that, let's say, overthrew our government and installed a puppet government of Islamicists, and then insisted that we'd have free elections and which would be supervised by Iraqis, we'd probably resent it too, and we'd probably resist. So I think there is no easy solution to the problem in Iraq. We have messed up their country pretty good, and we're going to have to allow them to settle there. And I would bet they would solve the problem. Like I said, it's hard to say what that solution would look like, but perhaps the kind of multi-party democracy that we're suggesting to them would be inappropriate for them. You know, and I might point out, too, that before we start forcing democracy on Iraq, we should start practicing it here at home. You know, it's like my exclusion is a good example of how we practice democracy. If you can imagine an Iraqi election where Iraqi Christians were considered too small a group to be included, would that be fair? I mean, in a sense, would that if the Iraqis were to follow our example, of course, you'd shut out all those smaller groups and just have the Shiites versus the Sunnis and ignore everybody else. Or probably two Shiite factions and ignore the Sunnis as well. But no, I think that notion of jumping on the train, or as Barack Obama put it, pulling the car out of the ditch, I think, in the last debate, those are inappropriate metaphors for a very complicated situation that we're not in a position to solve.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Kankakee, line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon, Celeste Quinn and United States Senate candidate Jerry Cohn. Mr. Cohn,
yes.
Would you please enumerate and discuss the powers of Congress and the power of the Senate to try impeachments and to give advice and consent to the president on treaties and appointments? Thank you.
Okay. Well, the Congress does have, they don't have the power of impeachment. That belongs with the House of Representatives. The Senate would try the case, sit as kind of a quasi-jury in the case of impeachments. And, of course, the Senate has the right to approve treaties as well under the Constitution. So if the president negotiates a treaty, it must pass muster with the U.S. Senate. I think Congress commits two mistakes. In one sense, they underestimate their power in the sense that they yield too much to the president. They need to stand up for their constitutional prerogatives and defending the Constitution against illegal usurpation of power by the president, and if necessary, impeach him when he does. But I think it would just simply take the power of the budget to really bring the president back into line to say, we will not fund any illegal programs. So impeachment probably wouldn't be necessary in most cases. The other mistake Congress makes, though, is they get carried away with their power in the sense that they believe they can legislate on just about any topic they imagine. I mean, I think a discussion in Congress on the topic of education is wholly inappropriate because there's no authority under Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution for Congress to do anything about education. That if you really want to, when it comes down to it, almost, I would say, 90% of the things that the government does are illegal under the Constitution. That we were set up as a federal republic where the state governments would have full sovereignty on just about everything except for foreign policy, and the Congress would restrict its activities to, diplomacy, foreign policy, defense, and it would be small government on a Jeffersonian scale that I think we need to get back to, and if we were to follow the Constitution, we would get back to that.
Okay, let's invite others to join us this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, the Libertarian candidate running to represent the state of Illinois in the U.S. Senate. You know, that caller said your name Cohn, and I was informed it was Kahn.
Yeah. It is pronounced Kahn, yes.
Okay.
My father changed it to Kahn. Actually, my uncle's all pronounced it Cohn, so K-O-H-N normally is pronounced Cohn, so that's understandable. But now I pronounce it Kahn.
Okay, very good. Let's talk with another listener. Let's go and talk to a listener in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hello. I have a question for the guest. I tend to support a lot of libertarian values, particularly the core values that you discussed earlier about basic self-rule and autonomy and so forth. But there's one thing I've always sort of had a trouble understanding as far as the libertarian platform goes, which is this emphasis on the economic side of that, and particularly the aspect of there seems to be a support, a sort of general blanket support for free trade. And from, where I'm coming from, and from evidence that I've seen, which seems to be overwhelming and certainly not ignorable, free trade in general, at least the system that's operating now worldwide, tends to actually sort of create less autonomy for most people in the world and certainly more economic disparity and other problems. And what I'm wondering is whether you would support a system that's different from the one that we call globalization as it is now, or whether you would sort of support the system that's in place right now. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. All right. Well, first, yeah, free trade. We don't really have free trade right now. What we have is state-managed trade, that these very elaborate 1,000-page agreements with other countries that lay out the conditions under which trade may occur. That I would agree with Ambassador Keyes that that is not free trade. Where I would disagree with Ambassador Keyes is that free trade is worth striving for. Really all I'm talking about when I say free trade is the right of people to buy what they want from whom they want and sell to whom they want what they want. It's basically allowing people the right to make deals. And voluntary trade, by its nature, is mutually beneficial because each party engaged in the trade is getting what they want in exchange for something they valued less. So both parties are better off as a result of having made that trade. And it works on a micro level, on a small local level, and it works on a global level. Now, is it going to guarantee a perfect world where everyone is equal? No. We all have different abilities. We all have different resources available. So we are going to have inequality, but that's not necessarily a bad thing in the sense that that creates the conditions by which voluntary trade is necessary. I mean, if we all had the exact same abilities, the exact same capabilities, then trade wouldn't be necessary. We'd all be living as little self-sufficient islands to ourselves. So no, I agree that the current situation is unsatisfactory, but that the answer is not more protectionism or more retreating into ourselves, but opening it up a little bit more.
A moment ago, you were talking about education, and you said the federal government has really no role in education or should have no role in education. And the national platform for the Libertarian Party advocates the complete separation of education and state.
Right. That's correct. And I would support that.
Yeah, okay. So no public education?
Yeah, and I know I'm talking to you from a public school here. You can probably hear the students in the hallway
right.
Here between periods. No, I actually, if I had my druthers, we would abolish public education entirely and privatize it. And that would mean, you know, of course, that we'd have two forms of education, private schools and homeschooling. And I think that we'd still, if you go back about 150 years, we didn't have any government-run schools. Schools were a private matter, and we had a very educated, literate population because parents would teach their children at home or form educational volunteer, kind of private schools or co-ops and things of that nature to educate their children. And I think we've regressed a little bit. The danger in putting government in charge of education, of course, is it becomes propagandized, that the school becomes an instrument by which we can train people to think the way the state wants them to think. And I think to some degree that where we're at right now is the result that we're seeing. I would certainly, gladly accept employment in a private school, actually. But the fact is the private sector is, I'm a teacher and I love to teach. And when the government has taken over 90% of your profession, it's kind of put me in a kind of awkward position here where I'm kind of a fifth column inside the public schools. But, whether public or private, I think this, I hope I bring something unique to my classroom. So, anyway.
Yeah. What do you think of the No Child Left Behind Act?
I think it doesn't work. Sorry about the slamming door here. I got teachers coming in and out. I think, again, it's unconstitutional. The government had no right to pass it under our Constitution, or no legitimate power to pass it. And from the inside here, I don't think it works. It's created kind of a mentality on the part of administrators, which is now filtering down to some of the teachers, that everything has to be geared to the test.